Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would the United States look like without bats? While many of us fail to notice these tiny creatures flitting about at night, they play a vital role in the world we inhabit during the day by eating huge numbers of insects, dispersing seeds, and pollinating plants. But over the past 3 years, a fast-spreading fungus known as white nose syndrome has killed an estimated 1 million hibernating bats, leaving scientists concerned that half a dozen North American species could go extinct in the very near future. Science journalist David Quammen is a contributing writer for National Geographic. His article about white nose syndrome in the December issue of the magazine is called Crash. David, welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be with you again.
What exactly is white nose syndrome?
Well, it is the set of symptoms that surround the presence of this fungus. The fungus itself is called Geomyces destructens, and it grows on bats in their hibernating caves, which tend to be cool and have relatively high humidity. Those are conditions that favor the growth of a fungus. This thing grows on the noses of the bats, but more crucially, it grows on the wings of the bats and creates sores, brittle spots, lesions on their wings that one way or another seem to lead to disaster and death for these large numbers of hibernating bats.
And part of the problem is that it wakes them up during hibernation because it's, I guess, the spots, the infection is sore or itchy?
Well, that's what they suspect. The scientists continue to have some new ideas and some new insights on this. I mean, they call it white nose syndrome because it's very, very prominent, very dramatic in some of the photographs that you see and some of the observations that the scientists make when they go into these caves. But it doesn't kill the bats, may not even hurt the bats by growing on their noses. It's possible that it causes death by waking them up in the middle of winter because it's irritant. It's an irritant. And when a bat wakes up, a hibernating bat wakes up in the middle of the winter, it'll fly around its cave for a while, and then apparently they go outside looking possibly for food, and it's winter out there, and there are no insects, and the temperature is wrong, and there's snow on the ground, and so the bats die. Hmm. So the irritation is one of the hypotheses, but there are some new ideas that are coming forward now, too, just in the last few weeks and months, even since my article went to press.
Let's also talk about the fact that during hibernation, you mentioned that if they go out of the cave, they search around, they don't find food. Ordinarily, they would have stored fat, but if they wake up, they're using a great deal more of that stored energy than if they're just lying there sleeping.
That's right. That's another of the considerations that's important. Bats hibernate, the species that hibernate through the winter, and their stored fat is very important to them. They're tiny little creatures, and they may get by through a winter on as little as 2 grams of stored fat. But their fat budget, their energy budget, is very tight. It doesn't allow them a lot of margin of error. So if they're waked up in the middle of the winter and they fly around, waked up more frequently than they ordinarily would, in an ordinary year, they would wake up a couple of times and stretch their wings and fly around. But if they're waked up too many times and they go outside and expend this energy, then it's disastrous for them because they need that stored fat to get them through the winter.
And this is particularly devastating to the little brown bat. Can you tell us about the little brown bat?
Yeah, well, the little brown bat is a species known scientifically as Myotis lucifugus. It hibernates in the Northeast and down into the Appalachians in caves. It tends to prefer caves that have a certain temperature range between about 40 and 45 degrees Fahrenheit and also a high humidity, up around 90%. Those are the conditions that the little brown in particular needs for hibernating. And unfortunately for the little brown, those are the conditions that seem to favor the growth of this fungus.
And I guess also during hibernation, their body temperatures drop.
That's right. That's right. And not only the body temperatures, but their heart rate, their breathing rate, and possibly also the level of their immune defense. Their immune system may dial itself down, may downregulate. during hibernation. There's some scientists working at Boston University, Tom Kuntz and a woman in his lab, Marianne Moore, who've explored this question of whether the downregulating of the immune system during hibernation might be one of the things that allows this fungus to take hold.
Do we know how it spreads?
We don't know how it spreads, but there is great fear that it's spread by humans.
Mm-hmm.
It's presumably also spread by bats, because bats tend to be faithful to their home hibernaculum. They go to the same cave year after year. But when they wake up in the spring, they fly around in the summer, they intermingle, they breed, and it's possible for the fungus to be passed from one bat to another and from one population of bats to another, so that it could end up then being carried back to a new cave and spreading among the bats of that cave. So that's the natural scenario of spread. But there's also great concern that that it's being spread by humans who are entering these caves, either tourists in some of the caves that are open to sort of casual visitation, or by cavers who go into caves. There is great concern within the caving community to limit the impacts of human visits, so the cavers are policing themselves, at least most of them are anyway, and are very responsive to this danger of spreading the spores of the fungus from one cave to another.
It could be as simple as somebody having a few spores on the same hiking boots they wore on their last trip somewhere.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the scientists who study this, including the scientists who go into caves that are not known to be infected to census the bats or to see whether the infection has arrived, those scientists, as I describe in the article, those scientists are very, very careful to eliminate the possibility themselves spreading the fungus from one cave to another.
You went with them on at least one of these missions to sort of check things out. Can you describe what happens when they go into a cave and they evaluate the population?
Yeah, we went to a place called, I guess I'm allowed to mention the name of it, Hubbard's Cave. Well, it's in the article, so I'm sure I am. Hubbard's Cave in central Tennessee. It's owned by the Nature Conservancy. It's not open to the public. It is in the mountains of central Tennessee at the end of a long mountain road. You drive up there, you get out, there's this huge sinkhole in the middle of the hardwood forest with a stream cascading down into the sinkhole. You climb down into the sinkhole. We used long aluminum ladders to go down into it. And then the cave, there are three cave entrances there. The cave entrances are blocked by large iron gates that keep keep cavers and other people from getting in unauthorized. The Nature Conservancy fellow who was with us unlocked one of these gates, and we crawled through this little gate hole, went inside the cave. And Hubbard's Cave is a particularly important hibernaculum for the gray bat, which is an endangered species of bat. And therefore, there's great concern over the gray bat in its hibernacula as to whether it has been hit so far by this disease. It seems not to have been hit, or it seemed not to have been hit at the time we were there. This cave is known to house about 500,000 bats, and so we climbed through the cave into the different chambers and found these big carpet-like patches of bats on the walls and on the ceiling, and the scientists made population estimates of the bats that were there, and examined individual bats to see if there was any sign of the fungus yet. And fortunately, at that point, there was no sign of the fungus, no sign of infection in that cave. But as one of the fellows from Bat Conservation International told me, it's not a matter of whether it's going to get there, it's a matter of when.
People will not be surprised to know that there are some extraordinary photographs accompanying the article by Stephen Alvarez. And the one in Hubbard's Cave really is amazing. You mentioned that it's carpet-like. If you didn't know what you were looking at and you sort of paged quickly through it, it would almost look like soil. They're so densely packed together.
Yeah. And that was an amazing experience for me, too. I mean, Stephen captured it beautifully in that photograph. It's a double-page spread in the magazine. And as I say in the article, it's like a big, dark brownish gray carpet hanging on the side of this tan limestone wall. It's like a huge buffalo rub, a buffalo robe, you know, furry and thick and dense, attached to the wall. The bats are hanging by their little feet to the porous limestone. And Jim Kennedy of Bat Conservation International estimated to me that there were probably about 300,000 bats just in that one patch on the wall.
Is there any noise when they're in there hibernating?
There is a little bit. You can, well, when if no human is there to listen, then we don't know, obviously, how much noise they're making. But when humans go in, even when we went in, very, very carefully, trying hard not to be disruptive, the bats do start to fly around a bit. Some of them are in the air. You can hear little chirpings. You can hear the rustle of their wings. You can feel them flying close past your face. It's a pretty tranquil, pretty quiet environment, but it's not absolutely silent.
So how lethal has the virus been, or the fungus been, rather, in the United States?
Well, it's been enormously lethal in the areas where it hit first. New York State, west of Albany, up into Vermont, New Hampshire, a bit in Connecticut, Massachusetts. In some of those areas, it's killed 90, maybe going on 99% of some of the populations in,
wow,
in hibernaculum caves there. It's been spreading since the winter of 2006 downward along the Appalachians. It's gotten down into Virginia, West Virginia, Kentucky, eastern Tennessee, and there are even some signs of it now, at least suspected presence, as far west as Arkansas and Oklahoma. In some of those places, it's just begun to arrive, but as I say, in some of the places where it hit first and has hit very hard, it's essentially exterminated or nearly exterminated populations of bats.
This is just so recent. When you say 2006, I mean, that's a blink in time. How was it first discovered?
Well, there was one cave in upstate New York, west of Albany, called Howe's Cave, and some people went there in the winter of 2006. I think it was probably January, early 2006, and they were outside the cave, and they saw bats flying around in the middle of winter, in the middle of January. You know, it was cold, it was snowy. These bats shouldn't have been there. It was daytime, and bats were flying around. So they reported that to the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, and the DEC then sent some crews out to that cave and also to another cave. On their annual inspections, they went to a place called Hale's Cave, where bats also hibernate. And they went into Hale's Cave, and they found a lot of dead bats on the ground. They essentially found a ragu, a stew of dead bats on the floor of the cave, as well as dead bats outside the cave. So that was the first alarm bell. There's a fellow with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, a mammal expert named Al Hicks, who made some of those inspection trips himself. I talked to him about this, and he said it was just horrible. It was devastating. It was like carnage in these caves.
David Quammen is my guest. His article in the December issue of National Geographic magazine is called Crash. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science journalist David Quammen, who is a contributing writer to National Geographic magazine and has an article called Crash in the December issue. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. David, I want to step back here for a minute because it may be that for some people listening to this, it sounds like a sort of abstract crisis, like we're sorry for the bats. But in fact, they play an incredibly important role that a lot of people don't recognize.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they eat huge, huge numbers of insects. They're important for agriculture. As you said at the beginning, they're important, some of them for pollinating plants. They are one of the linchpin guilds of species in our ecosystems in the Northeast and Midwestern United States, these hibernating bats. There are migrating bats that are important down in Texas. I'm sure that your listeners are well aware of the Mexican free-tailed bat and some of the huge population aggregations down there. You can't subtract suddenly a species or a group of species that operate in such abundance and play a role in regulating insects and pollination. You can't subtract them suddenly from an ecosystem and not have a cascade of events, not have consequences.
And I guess
we don't yet know what those consequences will be.
Yeah, I was going to ask if there has already been sort of an increase in insects and if farmers in the area are starting to notice a difference already.
I think probably, Chris, the answer to that is no, because as you said, this has happened so quickly. Mm-hmm. This has all happened just in the last 4 years. So it is it's almost like an instantaneous crash. It's not something, an extinction happening in geological time. It's happening in real human lifespan, blink of an eye time scale. And the ecological consequences will take a little bit longer to show themselves. And scientists can guess where they should start looking for those consequences, but I don't think anybody claims to have seen them yet.
So one really interesting twist in all this, David, is the fact that this fungus does exist and has existed for some time in Europe, and bats there don't seem to be devastated by it.
That's right, and the bat scientists in Europe are puzzled by that and very concerned about it. I was at a bat biologist meeting in Berlin in February, and after the main sessions each day, the scientists would get together in sort of private working group sessions, and they would talk about this fungus and the fact that it was causing such devastation in North America, and it's present in Europe, but hasn't yet caused this white nose syndrome, hasn't yet caused massive die-offs. But the European bat people are enormously concerned that it might. And if it doesn't, then it's potentially very important to figure out why and see if maybe some sort of a solution or a mitigation that can be applied to the situation in North America.
Yes, because I guess right now we don't know, have European bats evolved some kind of resistance, or perhaps has the fungus mutated since it's come to this country?
Is the fungus just a little bit different? I noticed I was doing a little bit of reading on this online this morning, and one of the bits of science that's come out just in the last couple of months is that scientists have sequenced the entire genome of the fungus, of Geomyces destructans. And so now they're starting to look at that genome to say, well, what is it that makes this fungus so devastating to American bats, and is the fungus any different between America and Europe? Can we see differences in the genome? Are there mutations that have perhaps caused it to be so dangerous in North America? So they're in the process now of trying to figure that out on the genetic level.
It would seem that if it's not the fungus that's different, maybe you could introduce some European bats to the United States and possibly allow them to breed, or would that take too long to have any impact?
That would be risky. Mm-hmm. Anytime you start moving species around like that, I mean, that's been tried in many cases in the past, dealing with one ecological problem by making an ecological transplant. And, for instance, rabbits were originally transplanted to Australia, and cane toads were transplanted to Australia intentionally because in each of those cases it was thought that they could have some beneficial effect on an ecological problem. And then they went wild. The rabbits multiplied hugely, and eventually they had to be killed off with the, or at least controlled with an introduced virus. And the cane toads are still going crazy. So moving European bats to North America is not likely to be one of the approaches that biologists recommend.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. David Quammen is here from National Geographic. His article in the December issue is called Crash. Let's go to the phones now, and we'll speak with Maggie in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hello. I worked as a cave guide in the Mammoth Cave area a couple decades ago, and it was understood at the time that humans and bats exchanged the histoplasmosis, the lung infection for humans. Although the doctors in the area tended to treat it as idiopathic when people got it, they couldn't prove you got it in a cave, but it was understood. So I'm wondering if there's a human equivalent between this disease now that could exchange back and forth, and if, pardon me, something like our pesticides, herbicides, antibiotics could be contributing to this.
What do we know about that, problem. David?
Well, that's a good question, Maggie. As far as they know so far, there's no crossover infection of this fungus in humans. There's no danger to humans. They're not concerned about that. There's nothing even similar to this fungus that affects humans. But the kind of thing that you're talking about, zoonotic transfer of a pathogen from one species to another, I mean, it's very important. I don't know about the histoplasmosis case. I assume that I can't remember. That's a bacterium. But there are a number of, for instance, of viruses that are carried by bats that spill over and seriously affect humans. And potentially human pathogens could cause effects on bat populations also. But this particular fungus doesn't fall into that category.
Talk for a minute about why it wouldn't make sense to come in with some kind of, when the bats are away for the night after they've finished their hibernation season, to come in with some kind of antifungal spray and try to disinfect a cave.
Well, they're talking about that, yeah. Even now, it's something else that I saw discussion of in the literature and online this morning. They're doing some experimental work on that, I think, at the laboratory level at this point. They're investigating several different fungicides, and they are very, very wary of those so far. I can't cite the particular fungicide or the group of fungicides, but I read this morning that one researcher found that applying this fungicide, the main effect was to kill the bats, too, because the bats were so sensitive. So that's a possibility. But it's, again, something that they want to proceed with very cautiously.
I guess, again, you can have the unintended consequences there. Even if it didn't kill bats, it might kill something else that's important to the ecosystem.
Absolutely. And these caves are living ecosystems. So there may be not just a lot of species of invertebrates, insects, and spiders and other things living in the caves. There may also be fungi that are natural and healthy parts of the cave ecosystems that you would kill off if you introduced a fungicide.
What kinds of animals? Are there any that prey on bats?
I'm not going to claim that I know the answer for sure on that. I'm not actually a bat expert, but I would guess that there are night-flying predatory birds that prey on bats. Absolutely, yeah. There may also be some cave-dwelling snakes that would prey on bats that hibernate in caves. But it doesn't seem to be something that is a serious drain on their population, is a serious limiting factor on their population levels.
Let's go back to this strategy of limiting human access to caves in case that is a significant factor in spreading this infection. Talk about the complications of that, given that there are caves on public land and there are caves on private land and people may go back and forth. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's touchy, as you say. Some of the caver community, the people whose hobby, whose avocation whose passion is exploring caves don't want caves closed. They're saying, well, it's not us. We're very careful. We're not causing this disease. Well, it's hard to prove that, very difficult to prove that. And the resource managers are saying, well, look, we've got such a devastating situation here that the presumption should be a presumption of caution. I noticed this morning that some caves on public land in the West, I believe Colorado and Utah, have just been announced to be closing as a precaution against the introduction of this disease. So,
and in some places, they're actually putting up gates at the mouth of caves.
They've been doing that for decades, actually, mm-hmm. Because there was such devastation caused by public, now, I won't say by serious cavers, but in some places by almost public vandalism, getting into some of the caves. People would go into these caves, including some of the caves where you have gray bats, now an endangered species, Indiana bats, also an endangered species. And people would go in there and disrupt the bats. Some people even killed the bats for fun with tennis rackets. So both the Nature Conservancy with its cave resources on private lands, some other conservation organizations, and some of the public agencies, the state agencies charged with protecting natural resources, fish and wildlife, have closed the caves by putting these big gates on them. And the reason they use big iron gates, I suppose it's obvious, but maybe not, is because that keeps the people out, but bats can still fly in and out in order to roost through the gaps in the gates.
Is there a particular kind of design, or can you just make the spaces big enough for bats to get through and they can figure it out?
I think that there's quite a science that's developed on the right kind of gates that exclude people effectively but don't impede the movement of the bats. I can't tell you what the specifics are, but I think that's the case.
As you mentioned earlier, we are very fond of our bats here in Texas, but historically they've had kind of a bad reputation. Is that changing to the extent necessary to get people concerned about a problem like this?
Well, I think so, and I certainly hope so. I mean, that's been one of the missions of Bat Conservation International, which is based there in Texas, down in Austin. Bat Conservation International has been operating for the last 30 years or so, to try and protect bat populations, but also to raise the level of awareness and appreciation for bats in the minds of the public. And that's one of the things we tried to do with the article in Geographic this month, too, to make people realize that, yeah, there are a lot of spooky, old, superstitious ideas about bats, but these are mammals, these are extraordinary creatures. They fly, they operate on a very, very small margin of survival, and they perform enormously important ecosystem services that we can't really afford to sacrifice.
It's funny that there are people who are sort of creeped out by bats because they're so darn cute if you happen to see one close up or a photograph of one close up.
They are, yeah. Although some of them, you can find some tropical bats that have pretty peculiar faces, mm-hmm. and I think maybe that's one of the things that's... given some people this cringe reaction. Some of the leaf-nosed bats, for instance, in the Asian tropics their common name sort of says it, leaf nose. They've got these large noses that sort of open out almost like an ear that helps with some of their transmission and reception of echolocation sounds.
Has there been any success with bats that are actively infected with white nose syndrome? If you were able, and I realize this is not feasible, but if you were able to capture those and give them some kind of topical antifungal agent or some kind of shot, would that work to fix them on a case-by-case basis?
Well, it might, but we're talking about huge populations
right.
here. And at the population level, the problem really can't be dealt with effectively by inoculating individual bats. There is some sign that if a bat is infected in the course of the winter during its hibernation and it isn't too badly infected, then it can come out during the summer and fly around at night in a much different sort of climate than the interior of the Hibernaculum caves, and it can essentially defeat this fungus. Its immune system comes back to full strength, and it can heal if it hasn't progressed too far.
Mm-hmm.
But then it goes back into the cave to hibernate again the following fall, the following winter, and it's exposed again there. And the next time around, it seems not likely to be quite as lucky.
What about synthetic roosting sites, things that people build that are known to be clean? Would that be helpful?
Well, there's talk about that too, yeah. There's talk about creating that kind of a thing, a protected hibernating site. It's an idea that's in the very preliminary stage, and you would have to figure out, well, if bats can come and go to roost in this Hibernaculum, then even if you start with a place that's clean, how are you going to keep it clean?
Yeah.
But essentially, the situation is so desperate that scientists are talking about all these possibilities. Nothing is off the table. Nothing is too far-fetched to be at least worth discussion at this point, because it is a desperate situation.
Is there adequate funding going into this research?
There is funding coming from the federal government. I think there's just been, I can't remember the number, I think I saw $1.6 million that has been allocated to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for work on this problem.
David Quammen is with us. He's a contributing writer for National Geographic magazine. His article in the December issue is called Crash. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You're welcome to join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Science journalist David Quammen is with us this hour. His article in the December issue of National Geographic magazine is called Crash. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. We will go to the phones now and this time speak with Bert in Dallas. Hello, Bert.
Hello. You know, I kind of follow the honeybees and their problems with, they're suffering from mysterious diseases. And then you have fungus and amphibians, and there's just any number of thousands of species that scientists are looking at individually. And if you pull back, you just sort of feel that there's some kind of invisible connection with, you know, the human bootprint of civilization. To me, when you talk about these issues, it really is just really you're really talking about the particulars of the Great Sixth Extinction that we've been hearing about, you know, caused by man. Can you you get a sense that scientists are talking about it on that level at all?
Boy, thank you for saying that, Bert. You saved me from saying those things. Yes, they are talking about it on that level. For instance, there has never been a population crash, certainly of a migrating species or guild of species in North America on this level, in this scope, in recorded or geological history as far as we know about it. Scientists are saying specifically that, look, this is a little bit similar perhaps to the fungal problem that amphibians are having around the world, the passage of a fungus that causes a disease called chytridiomycosis in amphibians, affects their skins, makes it difficult for them to regulate the internal physiology of their bodies because of this fungal infection. It's absolutely part of, as you say, the overall larger bootprint of humanity on this planet. We are stressing species because of chemical pollutants in the environment. We are destroying habitat. We are fragmenting habitat. We are moving organisms from one place to another, both intentionally and unintentionally. And all of those things are causing consequences of the sort that we see in the amphibians, in the colony collapse disorder of the bees, and now in these hibernating bats.
Is there any way to go back through history to the time before modern science existed and ascertain as to whether any other extinctions may have come about due to things like this?
Well, yeah, absolutely. We call that paleontology. And we can see in the fossil record that there were mass extinctions. Bert mentioned the sixth great mass extinction. He was alluding to the fact that there have been five previous great mass extinctions in the history of life on Earth that we can see in the fossil record. The most famous of those was the extinction at the end of the Cretaceous era that took out the dinosaurs, among other groups of species. So we can see that it's happened. Scientists generate hypotheses to explain why it happened. In the case of the Cretaceous extinction, for instance, now they're pretty convinced that there was some sort of a huge asteroid that hit the Earth essentially caused nuclear winter for a stretch of years that killed off a lot of, not just a lot of individual animals, but a lot of species. We can see that this sort of thing has happened in the past, but it's never before happened as a result of the activities of one other species. And now the sixth extinction is unique because all of these things are direct and indirect consequences of things that we humans are doing.
Is this linked at all to the changes that we've made in the climate?
I'm certainly not going to say it's not linked, but there's no evidence so far that this is a climate-related change.
Mm-hmm.
It could be something that the scientists are investigating, but there's no obvious linkage at this point as there is in you know, some of the population struggles and species endangerments that we see seemingly resulting from climate change.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time we'll speak with Joe in Ennis. Hi, Joe.
Hello. I was wondering if consideration had ever been made to raising insects and releasing them outside of critical hibernacula, during the winter. You could keep the insects warm and you know, flying insects. And as the bats were exiting the hibernaculum, have something for them to eat.
Well, as I've said, no idea is dismissed by the scientists who are considering this problem because it's so severe. But, Joe, I can kind of guess that there might be a couple of objections to that particular one in terms of its practicability. But rather than talking about that, how hard it might be to raise sufficient numbers of insects and to get them to fly and make themselves available to bats in the cold temperatures, say, of a New York State winter, I want to mention one other thing, and that is that the scientists are now suspecting that the lesions that this fungus causes on the wings of bats may be the key, not just that the fungus is waking bats up and sending them outside in winter, but that it is destroying their ability to regulate their water balance and other aspects of their internal physiology through their wings. If you get a chance to look at the article in National Geographic, there's this dramatic double-page spread right at the beginning, a photo by Steven Alvarez of a single bat in a laboratory with its wings spread out against a light table, and you can see these lesions in the wing. You can also see how delicate the wing of a bat is. Most of their body surface is made up by the skin of their wings, which is essentially naked skin, very, very thin, only three cells thin. The wing of a bat essentially is an external layer of cells on the top, one layer of blood vessels in between, and then another single layer of cells on the bottom. So the fungus eats into this and causes them, scientists now suspect, to lose water, to be unable to retain their water, lose water through this big surface area. And so the bats may not be so much starving as dying of thirst.
Hmm. It would seem also that with these lesions, and it is an extraordinary photograph because you see that it's as transparent as a butterfly's wing when you hold it up to the light. It's got to be harder to stay aloft if there are air holes through the surface of the wing.
It is, and it's not just that there are holes all the way through, but these lesions make the wings more brittle. They cause the wings to tear. They cause the wings to sort of fold and bunch up, and the bats don't seem to be as maneuverable as they would be with healthy wings. There's a woman named Carol Metier at the Wildlife Diseases Lab in Madison, Wisconsin, who's been studying this. She showed me these things in her laboratory when I visited there last winter, how these wing lesions affect the ability of these very, very delicate, papery structures to function as they should.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Chris in Fort Worth. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
Sir, I know you've gotten a lot of ideas, but I was just thinking that what about hanging, like, feeders all over the cave, not so they can access it and have it have, like, a not only sugar and nutrient, but also have an antifungal and maybe an immune booster. And that way you can kind of taper it off and put it seasonally, like there's certain seasons where it would be available. And you know what I'm saying? So
I do,
that way they
yeah.
could access it when they needed it or not.
I do. And I think it's wonderful that people are offering these ideas. Again, I think there's maybe a couple of practical difficulties with that one. These are insect-eating bats and not nectar-drinking bats. They can't adapt to the idea of feeding off of, say, a sugar solution or a nectar-like food inside the cave. They expect to fly outside and capture insects for the protein and the fat that they get in insect bodies. Chris, I think it's terrific that your listeners would offer ideas like this, that people would engage and try to imagine things that could be done to deal with this situation.
So people who want to get involved in a more fundamental way, is the Bat Conservancy, I know it's a nonprofit, are there memberships that people can get to sort of take part in this?
I believe there are. Bat Conservation International of Austin, Texas. I'm sure people can find it easily on the web. They can also learn more about this by going to the Fish and Wildlife Service's website, where there is a whole section devoted to white nose syndrome. I think you can Google white nose syndrome, and that'll take you, first of all, to the Fish and Wildlife Service official white nose syndrome website, where you can learn more about it and find out whether it has begun to affect bats in your state and see if there's something that people could do about it. But certainly Bat Conservation International and the Nature Conservancy are two private organizations, that are on the forefront of trying to deal with this problem.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Carrie in Fort Worth. Hi, Carrie.
Hello. Yeah, I'm an arborist. I deal with trees, and here we have a fungus, Ceratocystis fagaceae, oak wilt, common name. It's wiping out oak trees all across Texas and elsewhere in the United States, and then there's Dutch elm disease, which is also a fungus, which famously wiped out all the elm trees.
And the chestnut blight.
Yeah, and the chestnut blight. So we got you know, three different funguses that have caused massive deforestations. And is there something inherent about fungus that makes it a more aggressive pathogen? I mean, all of these things seem to be related to human activity. You know, Dutch elm disease was, at least the theory is, it was brought in with some lumber that came from Africa. So it was just a species where there was no natural resistance. No one knows for sure what caused oak wilt to suddenly pop up and start wiping on trees, you know, 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah.
That was you know, the question I thought of before I called, and then the caller prior to me mentioned the thing about, you know, ways of inoculating bats, and I was thinking, like, you know, motion detectors and a fogger or something at the entrance of it's like a bat cave where you can, like, spray them all with something, and something like that would work. You know, we have ways of treating trees. We have to treat them one at a time, and it's really hard. Anyway, those are my two questions.
In terms of the fungi affecting trees, I mean, it does seem like we hear more about that in connection with trees than we do other sorts of pathogens, you know, bacteria or viruses. And I'm just going to make a sort of a calculated guess on that, Carrie. Part of it is that a fungus tends not to thrive at higher temperatures, the higher temperatures that you find in a warm-blooded animal, so that you don't hear about really horrible, lethal fungi affecting warm-blooded animals, humans, apart from this situation, other mammals. You hear more about viruses and bacteria. But obviously trees aren't warm-blooded animals. Trees operate at a different temperature range, and it may be that the fact that they're not running blood through their veins at, you know, 98 degrees Fahrenheit might make them a little bit more susceptible to fungi.
If you had to briefly put it on a 1 to 10 scale in terms of optimism among scientists that something can be done to fix this before at least half a dozen bat species are wiped out, 10 being the least optimistic, the most optimistic, and 1 being the least, where would you put them?
Well, I don't want to say anything that will cause people to lose hope, because the scientists are not losing hope. They're working on this very hard. They're doing everything they can. But the fact that it's already crashed through populations in the Northeast, killing off 90% in some places, as I said, 99%, and that it's there doesn't seem to be any way that they've discovered so far to stop its spread, means that I would put that number pretty low.
David Quammen's article is called Crash. It's in the December issue of the National Geographic magazine. David, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
You're welcome, Chris. I enjoy it.
My name is
Chris. Serious as it is, I enjoyed talking with you about it.
As did I. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.